Hello and welcome to Dr. Andrew Kaufman's Healthy Living Livestream. My name is Alexander Raskovich, and the topic of this week is how to cure diabetes in 3 weeks. Before I bring Andy on screen, let me mention that if you'd like Andy to answer your questions live, then feel free to leave them in the comment section below, and I'll collect them and bring them forth immediately after the presentation. A replay of this presentation will be available right after the live stream on Rumble and Facebook. With that having been said, I will now bring on Dr. Andrew Kaufman.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another exciting Healthy Living live stream. I want to make a brief announcement before we get started with today's presentation that last evening began my Natural Detox mini course, which is a free offering to anyone who registers, and hopefully many of you were there with me last night. And I spoke about, basically, it's called healing from the inside out, how your body handles toxins and gets rid of them naturally, and how you can support essentially your body's normal detoxification processes. And you can watch the replay of that if you register. And the next installment, class number 2, is coming up tomorrow evening at 8 p.m. Eastern. And I will be talking about the pitfalls of detoxification, especially cleansing reactions, and how you can prevent those from getting in the way of your health restoration. So please check in the chat for the link to register for that exciting free offering, Nature's Detox Mini Course. Okay, today we are going to be speaking about diabetes, and specifically type 2 diabetes. So I'm going to start off just with some basics about exactly what that is. So diabetes is kind of defined as an alteration in your body's ability to manage its blood sugar levels. Those are the levels of glucose, essentially the body's main sugar, and it converts other dietary sugars into glucose, and how it regulates the levels in your blood, because from the blood, they would get taken up by the tissues to undergo carbohydrate metabolism. And this is regulated by a hormone, insulin. I'm sure many of you know this, and this is kind of a review. But insulin is secreted by the pancreas, and when blood sugar comes in from, you know, our diet or other sources into the blood, and it directs the sugar in the blood to essentially go inside the cells to be taken up and leave the blood, or to stay in the blood. And it also, of course, has regulatory abilities over fat storage, and is related to our weight, stature, and obesity as well. And when you develop type 2 diabetes, it is said to be due to insulin resistance, where the body does not respond to insulin in terms of taking blood sugar up into the cells. And that leaves the blood sugar in, the sugar in the blood at higher levels, where it becomes toxic to other organs and tissues. And those lead to complications of diabetes, such as peripheral vascular disease, vision loss, and blindness, heart attacks, strokes, and all the many other issues that we know happens over time related and associated with diabetes. So I'm not going to give the specific numbers that define, you know, whether it's pre-diabetes or diabetes, because those change over time and are not really important. The important thing is that there is dysregulation in this system. And of course, that leads to various types of interventions, mostly with pharmaceuticals, which don't really change any of the underlying issues. So let's look at how many people are affected by diabetes. And also, let me say that those complications lead to a lot of disability and death. And those numbers are quite staggering as well. We're not going to look at them specifically today. But Alexander, if you want to bring up the first slide, and this is a a large study that was done. And interestingly, it was funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So I'll let you conclude what the relevance of that is. But if we can look at the trend in the next slide. So what they did is they looked at the prevalence, which is how many people in any given moment suffer from a condition. In this case, it's diabetes type 1 and type 2. And this is global. So this is worldwide. I mean, not every single country, but they surveyed quite a number of countries in this study. And you can see they looked at actual data from 1990 at the left side of the graph up until 2020. And then after that, it's essentially a prediction or an extrapolation of the trend line, and you can see where it's going. So as of 2020, you can see that the prevalence is somewhere between 5 and 7.5%. And this is worldwide. And you can see the trend that there is a fairly sharp rise. And I want you to try to remember the shape of this graph, because we're going to look at some other graphs that have very similar shapes over the same time period of 1990 to 2020. And you can see here by 2050 that it's predicted to be 10% of the world population suffering from diabetes. Now, in the United States, we're actually ahead of the global curve here, and we're already at very close to 10%. So 1 in 10 Americans suffer from diabetes. Now, you can see also on this chart that there is a slight increase in type 1 diabetes, the red line on the bottom, but it is not nearly as dramatic as the rise in type 2. And if we looked at type 2 trends for different age groups, we would see a remarkable increase in young people, especially in adolescence and pre-adolescence, where previously that was never really seen at all. So this is quite a prevalent and important condition. We all know people who have been diagnosed with diabetes. So I would think there would be considerable effort to try and find the cause, or that the cause would be known. And I wonder if many of you out there think that the actual cause is known, that it's just by too much sugar or carbohydrates in your diet. However, when you start to look around the internet, you will find virtually all the websites. So, you know, the Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, the American Diabetes Association, the Centers for Disease Control, where they all have sections on their webpage that says what causes diabetes. And then in there, they won't list the cause. Now, in some places, like in the American Diabetic Association, they readily admit that the cause is unknown, according to science. But many of the other sites will just list risk factors, and those are really just statistical covariates, so that there's some correlation or association, but it doesn't tell you anything about the causal relationship. So, for example, there's a high correlation between diabetes and obesity, right? But does obesity cause diabetes? Does diabetes cause obesity? Or is there a common cause that leads to both factors? And that is the kind of missing part. But they definitely, you know, even if it was obesity that caused diabetes, then you'd have to say, well, what's causing obesity? Because it's not just eating more. If you look at the trends, that's not doesn't explain it. So we have, you know, basically the literature just reporting risk factors, which maybe help you predict if you'll develop diabetes, but they offer no explanation about the underlying cause. So let's look at some trends in food consumption to see if there are any clues. And Alex, if you want to bring up the next set of slides. So this was from a very interesting study, and it really looks at food availability rather than actual consumption, because it's looking at 100 years of historical, or more than 100 years. I think it goes back to early 1800. But if we can look at the next slide on the trends in dietary fats. And of course, you can zoom in and look at the 1990 to 2020 data, which would be at the right side of the graph, about 1/5 of the graph on the right side. But you can see here the trends away from animal fats and toward seed oils and plant fats. Now, in the top graph, there's a line that kind of starts, it goes straight up about halfway through the data, and it's gray and goes up very precipitously. And that is the graph for seed oil availability. And you can see that it trends very consistently with the rise in type 2 diabetes. And on the bottom graph, the brown or orange section represents plant-based fats used in food. And the blue section is animal fats. So you could see there has been a very significant trend away from animal fats like, lard and tallow, towards plant fats, which predominantly in the present includes seed oils. Now, in the top graph, there's a yellow line that represents other plant fats besides refined seed oils like margarines and hydrogenated fats, etc. So that's part of the trend you'll see on the bottom as well. And then this study also looked at sweeteners. If you go to the next slide, and you can see that the orange line on the bottom represents high fructose corn syrup. And you can see that that trend starts right around 1990 and seems to go up from there. And then there's been a little bit of a trail off. But you can see that in that period from 1990 to 2019, overall, in the top yellow bar, the amount of added sweeteners did increase, then it decreased a little bit. So there is a possibility that, sugar and high fructose corn syrup is involved, but it doesn't follow the same trend like we saw for the seed oils. So we've talked about some, food factors, and I'm not sure if we should consider seed oils as food, but we know that they may be implicated in these metabolic disorders, and there is some data showing their interference with insulin function. But what about chemicals that are not food? So let's bring up the next slide, which looks at the output of the chemical industry, and it's a very similar time frame to the diabetes data. And you can see that if we drew a trend line in here, it would be very similar in slope to the line we saw for type 2 diabetes. Now, this is a crude measure, of course, because this includes, all chemical manufacturing, not just specific chemicals that have been implicated with diabetes. But I think it is quite telling that it shows a parallel kind of relationship. Now, we can look, if you want to bring up the next slide, at some specific studies where they looked at in environmental chemical exposure and its relationship to diabetes. And sorry, I can't see the screen with you, so I got to bring this up on my little device. So this study, which was done by scientists from Johns Hopkins, predominantly is called Environmental Chemicals and Type 2 Diabetes, an Updated Systematic Review. And this was published in 2013. So this has been known about for quite a while. And this is not the only study I'm going to show you, but the highlighted portion I'm going to read: increasing evidence supports the role of environmental chemicals in diabetes development, including arsenic and other metals, persistent organic pollutants, phthalates, and bisphenol A. So let me just discuss those particular elements. So arsenic, which did show a statistical relationship in this study, is present in agricultural products as well as some chemical products. And rice is a big culprit. So it's important that you look into this issue. The Environmental Working Group has some good data on it and suggestions of how to mitigate any arsenic exposure if you do continue to eat rice, but it's definitely something you want to eat in moderation. Now, persistent organic pollutants is a broad category that includes a variety of different types of chemicals, but ones that do not easily degrade and remain in the environment, or they degrade into something else that has a very long life in the environment. So it's not naturally broken down by like ultraviolet light from the sun or by microorganisms or other elements in the environment. And we know, for example, PFAS or perfluoroalkyl compounds is one example of those types of persistent pollutants, but it also includes DDT and related compounds, dioxins, some flame retardants. And then it mentions specifically phthalates and bisphenol A, and those are two endocrine disrupting chemicals that are essentially plasticizers. And we know about those. But I want to mention when discussing those, because it's mentioned specifically bisphenol A, but we have, and I did describe this previously, this kind of policy and industry cycle that has been referred to as the whack-a-mole, because companies are allowed to use these chemicals and put them out in the environment with no safety testing. But then if they are discovered post-marketing to be dangerous, then the company has to either they get regulated, they can't use that substance, or the publicity is too negative that there's a marketing advantage or a business advantage to take it out of their product. But when they do this, they simply substitute a similar chemical. So with BPA, for example, they might have a BPA-free product, but instead they'll put BPS in it. And BPS, another bisphenol, has similar toxicity and chemistry to BPA. So we're really not removing the toxic chemicals. We're just substituting one toxic chemical for another until it gets discovered that that one is toxic. So as a result, there may be a lot of underestimation of some of these effects in terms of the metabolic and other toxic effects. So let's go to the next slide here, which is another study done specifically on endocrine disrupting chemicals, of which I mentioned a couple, but there are others besides phthalates and bisphenols. And in fact, there are some in food, some natural endocrine disruptors as well, like genistein from soybeans. But let me read from this study here. And this was published in 2023, so this is more recent. In recent years, increasing body of evidences from both human and animal studies have displayed an association between exposure to early unfavorable life factors such as endocrine disrupting chemicals and the prevalence of type 2 diabetes later in life. The exogenous EDCs or endocrine disrupting chemicals can lead to disadvantaged metabolic consequences because they interfere with the synthesis, secretion, transport, binding, action, and metabolism of endogenous hormones, insulin being one of them. So you can see that there is accumulating over time more and more data from humans, animals, and even from molecular studies that support this causal relationship between environmental chemicals and type 2 diabetes. And I'm going to put one more study up before I get to how we can therapeutically address these issues. And here, this one is looking at perfluoroalkyl substances, so the PFAS forever chemicals and risk. And I'll just read the conclusory statement here. Background exposure to PFASs in the late 1990s were associated with higher type 2 diabetes risk during the following years in a prospective case control study of women from the special study that's done with the government for blood pressure that's used for a lot of purposes. These findings support a potential diabetogenic effect of PFAS exposure. So diabetogenic means essentially causing or creating diabetes. So we see that the official bodies don't really mention very much these associations with environmental chemicals. However, the research literature is finding more and more evidence of a likely causality here. So if this is the case, is there any further evidence, and how can we address this particular cause? So one piece of evidence is that for folks that have tried to address diabetes with just changing their diet have had a lot of success, but not all of them have been able to reverse their diabetes. And those that have reversed it may find that in the future, if they go back to some questionable dietary habits, that the diabetes may easily return. And in the literature, the mainstream reports that this is not really considered a cure. So why is this, and how do we address it? So we have to look first, you know, at the obvious. So one is there adequate hydration? And we need to address that. And the reason for that is because the kidneys help balance this system. And if the blood sugar goes up too high, if it goes up really high, especially, it can be become dangerous and even an acute emergency. But the kidneys are able to diurese out the sugar, but we have to have adequate hydration with water for that to happen. So it's not going to reverse things, but it's definitely required for the body to maintain homeostasis. And while we address it, it's vital to be adequately hydrated. Now, dietary changes are obviously paramount. And the most important thing is to get rid of processed food and to get rid of processed carbohydrates from the diet and observe, at a minimum, a whole food diet. Now, in my opinion, a ketogenic or a carb-free diet is the best way to optimize healing from diabetes. And so this would be like a ketogenic type diet, and there are a variety of options out there, but make sure you don't include, you know, keto-friendly processed foods. This should only be a whole food ketogenic diet. And many people can, you know, completely get off any medications just from doing this. It may take some time, like months, to depending on how severe the situation is. But many of you will find that you won't be able to get complete reversal or, you know, what might be considered a cure. But you may get a remission, and this is definitely a reasonable way to go. But why does it not work fully or in everyone? And in my opinion, the missing link here is these environmental chemicals that are interfering with metabolic and endocrine regulation that are really preventing the last bit of healing. Now, many of these compounds actually can be eliminated from your body, or some of them anyway, just from dietary changing or from water fasting or procedures like that. And mostly those are the ones that are water soluble. However, the seed oils, for example, and the PFAS and dioxin and many other of these compounds are not water soluble. And the body has a very difficult time eliminating them. And they've been shown to be present in adipose tissue, in fatty tissue. For example, seed oils tend to be mixed up with the lipids in fat cells that are said to make up the membrane. So when they fractionate them, they find seed oils like linoleic acid mixed in with the other lipids, right? And then they've found other of these chemicals, as I mentioned, also in the fatty tissue. So your body has a very hard time getting rid of these. And I believe this is really the missing aspect. So what can you do to address this and get these out of your body? So one thing is, firstly, you want to mitigate exposure from this point forward. And two of the biggest exposures to some of these chemicals is one from plastics, and especially if you microwave plastics. It's been shown that you will leach out some of the plasticizing chemicals, which are endocrine disruptors that I mentioned previously. So it's very important to, you know, stop using plastics for food storage, and especially in the microwave is the most dangerous aspect. Now, I neglected to mention that even some of the plasticizing chemicals that may have some solubility in water, like bisphenols, I believe, and possibly phthalates, oftentimes they are embedded in microplastic particles, for example, which have also been shown to be prevalent in various organs and tissues in the body. So even if they might be water soluble, these could still be sequestered in those microplastic particles. So how would we, you know, dissolve plastics similar to the fat soluble components? So what I have found to be have amazing success in this area, and very rapid success, is essentially using healing solvents, which are elements from nature. They are oily liquids from nature. Like, for example, castor oil, I've mentioned many times, is an example of a healing solvent. But there is one particular solvent I'm going to mention in a moment, which can penetrate throughout the whole body when taken internally. It can go through the skin when used topically, and it seems to have the best solubility profile to get these really non-polar, non-water soluble substances and dissolve them out so that your liver can process them and get them completely out of your body. And I'm referring here to the terpenes of the pine tree. And I have to be careful about how I refer to this due to censorship, because this is a material that used to be one of the most common remedies. If you go back, for example, to the 1899 Merck Manual, you'll find that it was listed as a remedy for, you know, over 40 health conditions, including serious life-threatening health conditions. And it does remain in one over-the-counter product after it was banned by the FDA in the 1940s, and that's Vicks VapoRub. And I will be talking more about this in my natural detox mini course and an upcoming very exciting workshop that I'll be announcing to you next week. But in my experience, all the clients who I've worked with and other people who have told me they've used this substance in a protocol, because you have to make sure that you use a protocol and use it wisely and appropriately based on people's experience and success, that they essentially have completely normal blood sugars within 3 weeks. Now, this, of course, does also involve changing your diet in conjunction, but it happens much quicker than with diet alone. And even people who have not been able to completely get off blood sugar medications, for example, with diet alone, have been successful using this approach. But I want to caution you, there is one major drawback, which is that your blood sugar will drop so fast that if you continue to take your diabetes medicine, you can put yourself at risk of an emergency or even death. So the big caution is that if you take any kind of medication that lowers your blood sugar, and you're going to do this type of cleansing using this potent healing solvent, you have to make sure that you taper off or completely stop when necessary any of those diabetes medicines, because it's far more dangerous for your blood sugar to go too low. In fact, 1% of people with diabetes end up in the emergency department related to a low blood sugar, and there is a high mortality rate. So I just want to give this caution, because this approach is so potent, it will happen very quickly, and you want to be prepared so you don't bottom out. So everyone, I hope this has been an enlightening and educational experience to learn what is truly likely to be implicated as the main cause of this unfortunate trend of rising prevalence of diabetes and all its associated complications, disability, and mortality, and how you can go beyond just diet and hydration and actually completely reverse this problem by dissolving those environmental toxins out of your body with the most potent pine-based healing solvent from nature.
Right. That was excellent, Andy. Did you want to mention the Power of Pine workshop as well?
Well, I know we haven't opened the doors for that yet, so I was going to make a major announcement this week. But if you are registered for the Natural Detox mini course, you will automatically be invited into that workshop.
All right. Let's go to some questions. We have a question from Zorro. What types of breads are safe to eat?
What types of breads? Was that the question?
Yes. What types of breads?
If you have diabetes, none. But in general, if you're in good health and maintain yourself, I think that the Weston A. Price philosophy of nutrition is a pretty reasonable way to go. And they would say that sourdough breads are an adequate way to eat bread. So I would support that.
All right. Question from Susprilla. Is neuropathy a common cause of diabetes, and can neuropathy from diabetes be reversible?
Well, so neuropathy is not a cause of diabetes. Neuropathy is a consequence of diabetes. From when I was mentioning the excess sugar in the blood is toxic to various organs and tissues, that includes the peripheral nerves. So, you know, it's even referred to as diabetic neuropathy. And yes, this is potentially reversible, but it's contingent upon reversing the diabetes.
All right. Question from Mackie. Do you think these findings increase risks of type 1 diabetes as well? My kids and I are pre-diabetic, but it seems to be type 1. We aren't making adequate insulin.
Right. Well, I've never heard of pre-diabetes for type 1, so I'm not sure how accurate that information may be. But as you saw from the graph that I displayed about the prevalence of type 1 and type 2 diabetes, we don't see the same kind of increase in type 1 diabetes. So it doesn't match up with the trends and has not, you know, I'm not aware of any specific research studies. So my, you know, current opinion would be that type 1 diabetes has a different cause. And it is, of course, much less common. But it's still, there's a possibility that it can be completely reversed at a minimum. And I have had experience with several clients. It is definitely possible to substantially lower your insulin requirement by doing detoxification, as I described. And I've seen clients reduce it by 90% or higher.
Right. We have a question from Bickwell. Does this protocol work for those who have many diabetic or type 2 diabetic symptoms like heart circulations, etc.?
Well, you know, usually in situations like this, all of those conditions have similar or the same cause, generally from toxicity with a variety of different chemicals and other factors like chronic dehydration. So, you know, the healing approach is going to be similar if they all have a similar cause. And this is, you know, see what is shown in the literature is that there are a lot of associations of other chronic diseases with diabetes.
All right. Last question. Can vitamin B1 help with type 2 diabetes?
Well, I mean, certainly we need to have adequate nutrition in order to heal properly. But, you know, there is a misconception out there that you can just, you know, go and take a substance, one single substance or one single pill, and it can by itself actually do something in your body. So I want to, you know, clear it up that one is only your body can actually heal. And any materials you provide are simply supporting the body's actions, but they don't actually take any action. Okay. So, you know, when you put food in your body, when you put a pill in your body, if you put a natural healing substance in your body, those things are not alive. They don't do things. What actually happens is that they stimulate the body to do something. So our bodies react to that substance. Now, with most pharmaceuticals, the reaction would be, you know, similar to poisoning. And that can sometimes relieve other symptoms that we have because the body says, oh, there's a bigger emergency to deal with this poison. We'll forget about, you know, that problem for a minute. And you can get symptomatic relief. So we've got to start thinking about that. Now, just, you know, taking some isolated vitamin made in a chemical factory and putting in your body is not going to stimulate your body, you know, to heal completely from a complicated process like diabetes. Even using the healing solvent that I was discussing about, that's just one element in an overall protocol. And you can't just, you know, willy-nilly use that either by itself. And you can, you know, it's got to be a comprehensive approach to create the necessary conditions that your body can take the action to fully heal itself from these metabolic derangements.
All right. That was excellent, Andy. Thank you so much for that wonderful presentation. Guys, don't forget our second 3-day mini detox presentation takes place tomorrow at 8 p.m. ET. So make sure to register using the link down below. Now, without any further ado, would you like to mention anything else, Andy, before we close off?
Well, I just want to say that it was a pleasure to deliver this information. I know there are many people who can benefit from this, and we can really turn around this pandemic of diabetes completely with, you know, very low cost and mostly lifestyle changes. So I look forward to seeing all of you next week, as well as tomorrow evening for the Natural Healing mini course. I will see you all then.
All right, guys. Cheers.